maze without the markers to help her find her way back. One passageway was so narrow she had to turn sideways to slip through it. Her eyes touched upon one tormented face after another, each entombed colonist caught in a rictus of agony. Something grabbed her. Her knees sagged, and the breath went out of her before she could even scream. But the hand was human. It was attached to an imprisoned body surmounted by a face. A familiar face. Carter Burke.
Ripley!
The moan was barely human.
Help me! I can feel it inside. It's moving.
She stared at him beyond horror now. No one deserved this.
Here.
His fingers clutched convulsively around the grenade she handed him. She primed it and hurried on. The voice of the station boomed around her. There was a rising note of mechanical urgency in its tone.
You now have 11 minutes to reach minimum safe distance.
According to the locator, she was all but on top of the target. Behind her, the grenade went off, the concussion nearly knocking her off her feet. It was answered by a second, more forceful eruption from deep within the station itself. A siren began to wail, and the whole installation shuddered. The locator led her around a corner. She tensed in anticipation. The locator's rangefinder read out zero. Newt's tracer bracelet lay on the tunnel floor, the metal fabric shredded. The glow from its sender module was a bright, cheerless green. Ripley sagged against a wall. It was all over. All over. Newt's eyes fluttered open, and she became aware of her surroundings. She had been cocooned in a pillar-like structure at the edge of a cluster of ovoid shapes, alien eggs. She recognized them right away. Before they'd been carried off or killed, the last desperate adult colonists had managed to acquire a few for study. But those had all been empty, open at the tops. These were sealed. Somehow the egg nearest her prison became aware of her stirrings. It quivered and then began to open, an obscene flower. Something damp and leathery stirred within. Transfixed by terror, Newt stared as jointed, arachnoid legs appeared over the lip of the ovoid. They emerged one at a time. She knew what was going to happen next, and she reacted the only way she could, the only way she knew how. She screamed. Ripley heard, turned towards the sound, and broke into a run. With horrible fascination, Newt watched as the facehugger climbed out of the egg. It paused for a moment on the rim, gathering its strength and taking its bearings. Then it turned towards her. Ripley came pounding into the chamber as it poised to leap. Her finger tensed on the pulse rifle's trigger. The single shell tore the crouching creature apart. The flash from the muzzle illuminated the figure of a mature alien standing nearby. It spun and charged the intruder just in time for twin bursts from the rifle to catapult it backward. Ripley advanced on the corpse, firing again and again, a murderous expression on her face. The alien jerked onto its back, and she finished it with a flamethrower. While it burned, she ran to Newt. The resinous material of the girl's cocoon hadn't hardened completely yet, and Ripley was able to loosen it enough for Newt to crawl free.
Here!
Ripley turned her back to the girl and bent her knees.
Climb aboard!
Newt clambered up onto the adult's hips and locked her hands around Ripley's neck. Her voice was weak.
I knew you'd come.
So long as I could still breathe. Okay, we're getting out of here. I want you to hang on, Newt. Hang on real tight. I'm not going to be able to hold you because I've got to be able to use the guns.
She didn't see the nod, but she felt it against her back.
I understand. Don't worry, I won't let go.
Ripley sensed movement off to their right. She ignored it as she blasted the eggs with a flamethrower. Only then did she turn it on the advancing aliens. One almost reached her, a living fireball, and she blew it apart with two bursts from the rifle. Ducking beneath a glistening cylindrical mass, she retreated. A piercing shriek filled the air, rising above the pounding of failing machinery, the wail of the emergency siren, and the screech of attacking aliens. She'd have seen it earlier if she'd looked up instead of straight ahead when she'd entered the egg chamber. It was just as well that she hadn't, because, despite her determination, she might have faltered. A gigantic silhouette in the ruddy mist, the alien queen glowered above her egg cache like a great, gleaming, insectoid Buddha. The fang skull was horror incarnate. Six limbs, two legs, and four taloned arms were folded grotesquely over a distended abdomen. Swollen with eggs, it comprised a vast tubular sac that was suspended from the latticework of pipes and conduits by a web-like membrane, as though an endless coil of intestine had been draped along the supporting machinery. Ripley realized she'd passed right beneath part of the sac a moment earlier. Inside the abdominal container, countless eggs churned towards a pulsating ovipositor in a vile organic assembly line. There they emerged, glistening and wet, to be picked up by tiny drones. These miniature versions of the alien warriors scuttled back and forth as they attended to the needs of both eggs and queen. They ignored the staring human in their midst as they concentrated with single-minded intensity on the task of transferring newly deposited eggs to a place of safety. Ripley remembered how Vasquez had done it as she pumped the slide on the grenade launcher, pumped and fired four times. The grenades punched deep into the flimsy egg sac and exploded, blowing it to shreds. Eggs and tons of noisome, gelatinous material spilled over the floor of the chamber. The queen went berserk, screeching like a psychotic locomotive. Ripley laid about with a flamethrower, methodically igniting everything in sight as she retreated. Eggs shriveled in the inferno, and the figures of warriors and drones vanished amid frenzied thrashing. The queen towered above the carnage, struggling in the flames. Two warriors closed in on Ripley. The pulse rifle clicked empty. Smoothly, she ejected the magazine, slammed another one home, and held the trigger down. Her attackers vanished in the homicidal hail of fire. It didn't matter if it moved or not. She blasted everything that didn't look wholly mechanical as she ran for the elevator, setting fire to equipment and destroying controls and instrumentation together with attacking aliens. Sweat and steam half blinded her, but the flares she dropped to mark her path shone brightly, jewels set among the devastation. Sirens howled around her, and the station rocked with internal convulsions. She almost ran past one flare, skidded to a halt, and turned towards it. She staggered on as if in a dream, her lungs straining no longer. Her body was so pumped up, she felt as though she were flying across the metal floor. Behind her, the queen detached from the ruined egg sac, ripping it away from her abdomen. Rising on legs the size of temple pillars, she lumbered forward, crushing machinery, cocoons, drones, and anything else in her path. Ripley used the flamethrower to sterilize the corridor ahead, letting loose incinerating blasts at regular intervals, firing down side corridors before she crossed them to keep from being surprised. By the time she and Newt reached the freight elevator, the weapons tank was empty. The elevator she'd used for the descent had been demolished by falling debris. She hit the call button on its companion and was rewarded by the whine of a healthy motor as the second metal cage commenced its slow fall from the upper levels. An enraged shriek made her turn. A distant, glistening shape like a runaway crane was trying to batter its way through intervening pipes and conduits to reach them. The queen's skull scraped the ceiling. She checked the pulse rifle. The magazine was empty, and she was out of refills, having spent shells profligately while rescuing Newt. No more grenades, either. She tossed the useless dual weapon aside, glad to be rid of the weight. The cage's descent was too slow. There was a service ladder set inside the wall next to the twin elevator shafts, and she scrambled up the first rungs. Newt was as light as a feather on her back. As she dived into the stairwell, a powerful black arm shot through the doorway like a piston. Razor-sharp talons slammed into the floor centimeters from her legs, digging into the metal. Which way now? She was no longer fearful, had no time to panic, too many other things to concentrate on. She was too busy being terrified. There, an open stairwell leading to the station's upper levels. It rocked and shuddered as the huge installation began tearing itself to bits beneath her. Behind her, the floor buckled as something incredibly powerful threw itself insanely against the metal wall. Talons and jaws pierced the thick alloy plates.
You now have 2 minutes to reach minimum safety distance, the sad voice of the station informed any who might be listening.
Ripley fell, banging one knee against the metal stairs. Pain forced her to pause. As she caught her breath, the sound of the elevator motors starting up made her look back down through the open latticework of the building. The elevator cage had begun to ascend. She could hear the overloaded cables groaning in the open shaft. She resumed her heavenward flight, the stairwell becoming a mad blur around her. There was only one reason why the elevator would resume its ascent. At last, they reached the doorway that led out onto the upper-level landing platform. With Newt still somehow clinging to her, Ripley slammed the door open and stumbled out into the wind and smoke. The dropship was gone.
Bishop!
The wind carried her scream away as she scanned the sky.
Bishop!
Newt sobbed against her back. A whine made her turn as the straining elevator slowly rose into view. She backed away from the door until she was leaning against the narrow railing that encircled the landing platform. It was 10 levels to the hard ground below. The skin of the heaving processing station was as smooth as glass. They couldn't go up and they couldn't go down. They couldn't even dive into an air duct. The platform shook as an explosion ripped through the bowels of the station. Metal beams buckled, nearly throwing her off her feet. With a shriek of rending steel, a nearby cooling tower collapsed, keeling over like a slain sequoia. The explosions didn't stop after the first one this time. They began to sequence as backup safety systems failed to contain the expanding reaction. On the other side of the doorway, the elevator ground to a halt. The safety cage enclosing the cargo bay began to part. She whispered to Newt,
"Close your eyes, baby."
The girl nodded solemnly, knowing what Ripley intended as she put one leg over the railing. They would hit the ground together, quick and clean. She was just about to step off into open air when the dropship rose into view almost beneath them, its hovering thrusters roaring. She hadn't heard it approach because of the howling wind. The ship's loading boom was extended, a single long metal strut reaching towards them like the finger of God. How Bishop held the vessel steady in the rippling gale, Ripley didn't know and didn't care. Behind her, she could just hear the voice of the station. It, like the installation it served, had almost run out of time.
You now have 30 seconds to reach.
She jumped onto the loading boom and hung on as it retracted into the dropship's cargo bay. An instant later, a tremendous explosion tore through the station. The resultant wind shear slammed the hovering craft sideways. Extended landing legs ripped into a complex of platform, wall, and conduit. Metal squealed against metal, the entanglement threatening to drag the ship downward. Inside the hold, Ripley threw herself into a flight seat, cradling Newt against her as she strapped both of them in. Glancing up the aisle, she could just see into the cockpit where Bishop was fighting the controls. As they retracted, the sound of the landing legs pulling free echoed through the little vessel. She slammed home the latches on her seat harness, wrapped both arms tightly around Newt.
"Punch it, Bishop!"
The entire lower level of the station vanished in an expanding fireball. The ground heaved, earth and metal vaporizing as the dropship erupted skyward. Its engines fired hard, and the resultant G's slammed Ripley and Newt back in their seat. No comfortable, gradual climb to orbit this time. Bishop had the engines open full throttle as the dropship clawed its way through the blighted atmosphere. Ripley's back protested even as she mentally urged Bishop to increase the velocity. As they left blue for black, the clouds lit up from beneath. A bubble of white-hot gas burst through the troposphere. The shockwave from the thermonuclear explosion rattled the ship but didn't damage it, and they continued to climb towards high orbit. Within the metal bottle, Ripley and Newt stared out of a viewport, watching as the blinding flare dissipated behind them. Then Newt slumped against Ripley's shoulder and began to cry quietly. Ripley rocked her and stroked her hair.
"It's okay, baby. We made it. It's over."
Ahead of them, the great, ungainly bulk of the Sulaco hung in geosynchronous orbit, awaiting the arrival of its smaller offspring. On Bishop's command, the dropship rose until docking grapples snapped home, lifting them into the cargo bay. The outer lock doors cycled shut. Automatic warning lights swept the dark, deserted chamber, and a warning horn ceased hooting. Excess engine heat was vented as the cavernous hold filled with air. Within the ship, Bishop stood behind Ripley while she knelt beside the comatose Hicks. She glanced questioningly at the android.
"I gave him another shot for the pain. He kept insisting that he didn't need it, but he didn't fight the injection. Strange thing, pain. Stranger to me still. This peculiar inner need of certain types of human to pretend that it doesn't exist. Many are the times I'm glad I'm synthetic."
"We need to get him to the Sulaco's medical ward," she replied, rising. "If you can get his arms, I'll take his feet." Bishop smiled.
"He is resting comfortably now. It will be better for him if we jostle him as little as possible. And you are tired. For that matter, I'm tired. It'll be easier if we get a stretcher."
Ripley hesitated, looking down at Hicks, then nodded. "You're right, of course." Picking up Newt, she preceded the android down the aisle leading to the extended loading ramp. They could have a self-propelling stretcher back for Hicks in a few minutes. Bishop continued to talk.
"I'm sorry if I gave you a scare when you emerged onto the landing platform and saw the ship missing. But the site had simply become too unstable. I was afraid I'd lose the ship if I remained docked. It was simpler and safer to hover a short distance away. Close to the ground, the wind is not as strong. I had a monitor on the exit all the time so that I'd know when you arrived."
"Wish I'd known that at the time."
"I know. I had to circle and hope that things didn't get too rough to take you off. In the absence of human direction, I had to use my own judgment, according to my programming. I'm sorry if I didn't handle it the best way."
They were halfway down the loading ramp. She paused and put a hand on his shoulder, stared evenly into artificial eyes.
"You did okay, Bishop."
"Well, thanks. I..."
He stopped in mid-sentence, his attention focused on something glimpsed out of the corner of one eye. Nothing, really. An innocuous drop of liquid had splashed onto the ramp next to his shoe, condensate from the skin of the dropship. The droplet began to hiss as it started to eat into the metal ramp. Acid. Something sharp and glistening burst from the center of his chest, spraying Ripley with milky android internal fluid. An alien stinger, queen size, driving straight through him from behind. Bishop thrashed, uttering meaningless machine noises and clutching the protruding point of the spear as it slowly lifted him off the landing ramp. The queen had concealed herself among the landing mechanism inside one strut bay. The atmospheric plates that normally sealed the bay flush with the rest of the dropship's skin had been bent aside or ripped away. She'd blended in perfectly with the rest of the heavy machinery until she began to emerge. Seizing Bishop in two huge hands, she ripped him apart and flung the two halves aside. Rotating warning lights flashed on her shining dark limbs as she slowly descended to the deck, still smoking where Ripley had half-fried her. Acid dripped from minor wounds that were healing rapidly. Sextuple limbs unfolded in unhuman geometries. Breaking out of her paralysis, Ripley lowered Newt to the deck without taking her eyes off the descending nightmare.
Go!
Newt bolted for the nearest cluster of packing crates and equipment. The alien dropped to the deck and pivoted in the direction of the movement. Ripley backed clear, waving her arms and shouting, making faces, jumping up and down, doing anything and everything she could think of to draw the monster's attention away from the fleeing child. Her decoying action was successful. The giant whirled, moving much too quickly for anything so huge, and sprang as Ripley sprinted for the oversized internal storage door that dominated the far end of the cargo hold. Massive feet boomed on the deck behind her. She cleared the door and flailed at the close switch. The barrier whirred as it complied with the command, moving much faster than the doors of the now vanished station. An echoing whang reverberated through the storage room as the alien struck the solid wall an instant too late. Ripley didn't have time to stand around to see if the door would hold. She moved rapidly among bulky, dark shapes, searching for a particular one. Outside, the queen's attention was drawn from the stubborn barrier to visible movement. A network of trench-like service channels, protected by heavy metal grillwork, underlaid the cargo bay deck like the tributaries of a river system. The channels were just deep enough for Newt to enter. She'd dropped through one service opening and had begun crawling, scurrying towards the other end of the cargo bay like a burrowing rabbit. The alien tracked the movement. Talons swooped, ripped up a section of grillwork just behind the frantic child. Newt tried to move faster, scrambling desperately as another piece of grill disappeared right at her heels. The next to go would be directly above her. The alien paused in mid-reach at the sound of the heavy storage room door grinding open behind her. In the opening stood a massive, articulated silhouette. Riding 2 tons of hardened steel, Ripley strode out in the power loader. Her hands were inside Waldo gloves while her feet rested in similar receptacles attached to the floor controls of the safety cab. Wearing the loader like high-tech armor, she advanced on the watching queen. The loader's ponderous feet boomed against the deck plates. Ripley's face was a mask of maternal fury, devoid of fear.
Get away from her, you!
The queen emitted an inhuman screech and leapt at the oncoming machine. Ripley threw her arm in a movement not normally associated with the activities of power loaders or similar devices, but the elegant machine reacted perfectly. One massive hydraulic arm slammed into the alien's skull and threw it back against the wall. The queen reacted instantly and charged again, only to crash into a backhand that literally landed like a ton. She fell backward into a pile of heavy loading equipment.
Come on!
Ripley wore a frenzied, distorted smile.
Come on!
Tail lashing with rage, the queen charged the loader a third time.
Four biomechanical arms swung at the loaders, too. The great stinger stabbed at the flanks and underside of the loader, glancing harmlessly off solid metal. Ripley parried and struck with sweeping blows of the steel tines, backing up the loader, then advancing, pivoting to keep the machine's arms between her and the queen. The battle moved across the deck, demolishing packing crates, portable instrumentation, small machinery, everything in the path of the fight. The cargo bay echoed with the nightmarish sounds of two dragons battling to the death. Getting the two powerful mechanical hands around a pair of alien arms, Ripley clenched her own fingers tight inside the Waldos, crushing both biomechanical limbs. The queen writhed with outrage, the talons of her other hands coming within inches of penetrating the safety cage to tear the tiny human apart. Ripley raised her arms, lifting the queen off the deck. The loader's engine groaned as it protested against the excessive weight. Hind legs ripped at the machine, denting the safety cage protecting its operator. The alien skull inclined towards her, and the outer jaws began to part. Ripley clung grimly to her controls. The inner, striking teeth exploded towards her. She ducked, and they slammed into the seat cushion behind her in an explosion of gelatinous drool. Yellow acid foamed over the hydraulic arms crawling towards the safety cage. The queen tore at high-pressure hoses. Purple fluid sprayed in all directions, machine blood mixing with alien blood. As it lost hydraulic pressure on one side, the loader crumpled and fell over. The queen immediately rolled to get on top of it, avoiding the crushing metal arms, trying to find a way to penetrate the safety cage. Ripley hit a switch on the loader's console, and its cutting torch came to life, the intense blue flame firing straight into the alien's face. It screamed and drew back, dragging the loader with it. As she fell and the world was turned upside down around her, Ripley's safety harness kept her secured to the driver's seat. Together, machine, biomechanoid, and human rolled into the rectangular pit of the loading dock. The loader landed on top of the alien, crushing part of its torso and pinning it beneath its great weight. Acid began to seep in a steady flow from the badly damaged body. Ripley's eyes widened as she fought with the loader's controls. The dripping acid spread out over the airlock doors and began to smoke as it started eating its way through the super-strong alloy. Beyond the outer dock lay void. As the first tiny holes appeared, she struggled to unstrap herself from the driver's seat. Air began to leave the Sulaco as the insatiable emptiness of space sucked at the ship. A rising wind tore at Ripley as she stumbled clear of the loader. Jumping a puddle of smoking acid, she grabbed at the bottom rungs of the ladder that was built into the wall of the airlock. One hand slapped the inner door's emergency override. Above, the heavy inner airlock doors began rumbling towards each other like steel jaws. She climbed wildly. Beneath her, the first holes widened, were joined by others as the acid did its work. The flow of escaping air around her increased in volume, slowing her ascent. Newt had emerged from the network of subfloor channels to hide among a forest of gas cylinders. When the power loader, Ripley, and the alien had tumbled into the airlock, she'd slipped out for a better look. Now the suction from below pulled her legs out from under her and dragged her, kicking and screaming, across the smooth deck. Bishop, or rather his upper half, saw her coming. He grabbed a support stanchion with one hand. With the other, he reached out and, thanks to perfect synthetic timing, just managed to get his fingers entwined in the girl's belt as she slid by. She hung there in his grasp, floating in the intensifying gale like a Newt flag as the wind sucked at her. Ripley's head emerged above deck level. As she tried to kick up and out with her right leg, something caressed her left ankle and latched hold. An experimental tug almost tore Ripley's arms from their sockets.
Desperately, she threw both arms around the ladder's upper rung, which was mounted a foot away on the deck. The inner airlock doors continued rumbling towards one another. If she didn't pull herself clear or drop back down within a couple of seconds, she'd end up looking just like Bishop. Below, the acid-weakened outer lock doors groaned. A portion of the inner reinforcing collapsed. The interlocked power loader and alien queen settled a few centimeters. Ripley felt her arm giving way as she was dragged down, but it was her shoe that came away first. Her leg was free. Summoning strength from unknown depths, she dragged herself onto the deck just as the inner airlock doors slammed shut. Beneath her, the alien queen uttered another scream of rage and exerted all her incomprehensible strength. The heavy loader squealed as she began to push it aside. It was half off when the outer doors, honeycombed by acid, fell apart, sending chunks of metal, bubbles of acid, the queen and the power loader spilling out into space. Ripley rose and stumbled to the nearest viewport. The queen's efforts were enough to propel her clear of the Sulaco's artificial gravity field. Still screaming and tearing at the power loader, the queen tumbled slowly back towards the inhospitable world she'd recently fled. Ripley stared as her nemesis faded to a dot, then a dim point, and was at last swallowed by the rolling clouds. Within the cargo bay, turbulent air eddied and settled as the Sulaco's cyclers worked to replenish the atmosphere that had been lost. Bishop was still holding Newt with one hand. His bisected torso trailed artificial inner organs and sparking conduits. His eyelids fluttered, and his head sometimes jerked unpredictably, bumping against the deck. His internal regulators had managed to shut off the flow of android blood, fighting a holding action against the massive injury. White encrustation sparkled along the edge of the tear. He managed a small, grim smile as he eyed the approaching Ripley.
"Not bad for a human."
He regained control of his eyelids long enough to give her an unmistakable wink. Ripley stumbled over to Newt. The girl looked dazed.
"Mommy? Mommy? Right here, baby. I'm right here."
Sweeping the girl up in her arms, she hugged her as hard as she could. Then she headed towards the Sulaco's crew quarters. Around them, the big ship's systems hummed reassuringly. She found her way up to medical and returned to the cargo hold with a stretcher in tow. Bishop assured her that he could wait. With the stretcher's aid, she gently loaded the sleeping Hicks and trundled him back to the hospital ward. His expression was peaceful, content. He'd missed the whole thing, luxuriating in the effects of the injection Bishop had given him. As for the android, he lay on the deck, his hands crossed over his chest and his eyes closed. She couldn't tell if he was dead or sleeping. Better minds than hers would determine that once they got back to Earth. In sleep, Hicks's face lost much of its macho marine toughness. He looked much like any other man. Handsomer, though, and certainly more tired. Except that he wasn't like any other man. If it hadn't been for him, she'd be dead. Newt would be dead. All dead. Only the Sulaco would have lived on, an empty receptacle awaiting the return of humans who would never come. She thought of waking him, decided against it. In a little while, when she was sure that his vital signs were stabilized and the repairs to his acid-scarred flesh well underway, she'd place him in one of the empty, waiting hypersleep capsules. She turned to inspect the sleeping chamber. 3 capsules to prep. If he still lived, Bishop wouldn't need one. the synthetic would probably have found hypersleep confining. Newt looked up at her. She held two of Ripley's fingers as they strode together up the corridor.
Are we going to sleep now?
That's right, Newt.
Can't we dream?
Ripley gazed down at the bright, upturned face and smiled.
Yes, honey. I think we both can.
This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of Alien 3, the next installment in the Alien novelizations, Free.
Final report of the commercial starship, Nostromo. Third officer reporting. The other members of the crew, Kane, Lambert, Parker, Brett, Ash, and Captain Dallas are dead. Cargo and ship destroyed. I should reach the frontier in about 6 weeks. With a little luck, the network will pick me up. This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.
This is a Samson.
Samson, please give us
I don't have time. Just get the med pods fired up. We have people in trouble.
Samson, what's happening?
We were attacked by these creatures. We tried to seal them in, but things stuck to their faces.
Alien, Out of the Shadows. The Audible original drama. Download now.
That was Aliens, the official movie novelization by Alan Dean Foster, based on a screenplay by James Cameron, narrated by William Hope.
And now, a free preview of Alien 3. Alien 3, the official movie novelization by Alan Dean Foster, based on a screenplay by David Giler and Walter Hill and Larry Ferguson. Story by Vincent Ward. Read by Peter Guinness. Chapter 1. Bad dreams. Funny thing about nightmares. They're like a chronically recurring disease. Mental malaria. Just when you think you've got them licked, they hit you all over again, sneaking up on you when you're unprepared. When you're completely relaxed and least expect them. Not a damn thing you can do about it either. Not a damn thing. Can't take any pills or potions, can't ask for a retroactive injection. The only cure is good sound sleep, and that just feeds the infection. So you try not to sleep, but in deep space you don't have any choice. Avoid the cryonic chambers, and the boredom on a deep space transport will kill you. Or even worse, you'll survive, dazed and mumbling, after the sacrifice of 10, 20, 30 years of useless consciousness. A lifetime wasted gazing at gauges, seeking enlightenment in the unvarying glare of readouts of limited colours. You can read and watch the vid and exercise and think of what might have been had you opted to slay the boredom with deep sleep. Not many professions where it's considered desirable to sleep on the job. Not a bad deal at all. Pays good, and you have the chance to observe social and technological advance from a unique perspective. Postponing death does not equate with, but rather mimics, immortality. Except for the nightmares. They're the inescapable downside to serving on a deep space vessel. Normal cure is to wake up. But you can't wake up in deep sleep. The machines won't let you. It's their job to keep you under, slow down your body functions, delay awareness. Only the engineers haven't figured out yet how to slow down dreams and their bastard cousin, the nightmare. So, along with your respiration and circulation, your unconscious musings are similarly drawn out, lengthened, extended. A single dream can last a year, two, or a single nightmare. Under certain circumstances, being bored to death might be the preferable alternative. But you've got no options in deep sleep. The cold, the regulated atmosphere, the needles that poke and probe, according to the preset medical programs, rule your body, if not your life. When you lie down in deep sleep, you surrender volition to the care of mechanicals, trusting in them, relying on them. And why not? Over the decades, they've proven themselves a hell of a lot more reliable than the people who designed them. Machines bear no grudges, engage in no animosity. The judgments they render are based solely on observation and analysis. Emotion is something they're not required to quantify, much less act upon. The machine that was the Sulaco was doing its job. The four sleepers on board alternately dreamt and rested, speeding along their pre-programmed course, coddled by the best technology civilization could devise. It kept them alive, regulated their vitals, treated momentary blips in their systems. Ripley, Hicks, Newt, even Bishop, though what was left of Bishop was easy to maintain. He was used to being turned on and off. Of the four, he was the only one who didn't dream, didn't have nightmares. It was something he regretted. It seemed like such a waste of time to sleep, but not to dream. However, the designers of the advanced Android series to which he belonged would have regarded dreaming as an expensive frivolity, and therefore did not apply themselves to the resolution of the problem. Naturally, no one thought to inquire of the androids what they thought of the situation. After Bishop, who technically was part of the ship and not the crew, and therefore did not count, Hicks was the worst off of the sleepers. Not because his nightmares were any more severe than those of his companions, but because the injuries he had recently suffered did not lend themselves to extended neglect. He needed the attention of a modern, full-service medical facility, of which the closest example lay another 2 years' travel time and an enormous distance away. Ripley had done what she could for him, leaving final diagnosis and prescription to the efficient judgment of the Sulaco's medical instrumentation. But as none of the ship's medical personnel had survived the trouble on Acheron, his treatment was perforce minimal. A couple of years locked in deep sleep were not conducive to rapid healing. There was little she'd been able to do except watch him slide into protective unconsciousness and hope. While the ship did its best, his body labored to repair the damage. Slowing down his vitals helped, because that likewise slowed down the spread of potential infection, but about the internal injuries he'd suffered, the ship could do nothing. He'd survived this long on determination, living off his reserves. Now he needed surgery. Something was moving in the sleep chamber that was not a part of the ship, though in the sense that it too was wholly driven by programming. It was not so very different from the cold, indifferent corridors it stalked. A single imperative inspired its relentless search, drove it mindlessly onward. Not food, for it was not hungry and did not eat. Not sex, for it had none. It was motivated solely and completely by the desire to procreate. Though organic, it was as much a machine as the computers that guided the ship, though it was possessed of a determination quite foreign to them. More than any other terrestrial creature, it resembled a horseshoe crab with a flexible tail. It advanced across the smooth floor of the sleep chamber on articulated legs, fashioned of an unusually carbon-rich chitin. Its physiology was simple, straightforward, and designed to carry out but one biological function, and to do that better than any comparable construction known. No machine could have done it better. guided by senses that were a unique combination of the primitive and sophisticated, driven by an embedded imperative unequalled in any other living being, it scuttled determinedly across the chamber. Scaling the smooth flank of the cryonic cylinder was a simple matter for something so superbly engineered. The top of the chamber was fashioned of transparent metallic glass. Within slept a small organic shape, half-formed, blonde, innocent save for her nightmares, which were as sophisticated and frequently more extensive than those of the adults sleeping nearby. Eyes closed, oblivious to the horror which explored the thin dome enclosing her, she slept on. She was not dreaming. Presently the nightmare was concrete and very real. Far better that she remained unaware of its existence. Impatiently, the thing explored the sleep cylinder, beginning at one end and working methodically up to the head. The cylinder was tight, triple-sealed, in many ways more secure than the hull of the Sulaco itself. Though anxious, the creature was incapable of frustration. The prospect of imminent fulfillment of its biological imperative only excited it and drove it to greater efforts. The extensible tube, which protruded from its ventral side, probed the unyielding transparency which shielded the helpless body on the unreachable cushions, proximity to its quarry driving the creature into a frenzy of activity. Sliding to one side, it eventually located the nearly imperceptible line which separated the transparent dome of the cylinder from its metal base. Tiny claws drove into the minuscule crack as the incredibly powerful tail secured a purchase on the instrumentation at the head of the cylinder. The creature exerted tremendous leverage, its small body quivering with the effort. Seals were strained. The thing's effort was unforgiving, its reserves of strength inconceivable. The lower edge of the transparent dome snapped, the metallic glass splitting parallel to the floor. A sliver of the clear material, sharp as a surgical instrument, drove straight through the creature's body. Frigid air erupted from the cylinder until an internal emergency seal restored its atmospheric integrity. Prone on her bed of uneasy dreams, Newt moaned softly, her head turning to one side, eyes moving beneath closed lids. But she did not wake up. The cylinder's integrity had been restored just in time to save her life. Emitting periodic, unearthly shrieks, the mortally wounded crawler flung itself across the room, legs and tail flailing spasmodically at the transparent sliver which pierced its body. It landed atop the cylinder in which reposed the motionless Hicks, its legs convulsively gripping the crest of the dome. Shuddering, quivering, it clawed at the metallic glass while acidic body fluids pumped from the wound. They ate into the glass, into the metal base of the cylinder, into and through the floor. Smoke began to rise from somewhere beneath the deck, filling the chamber. Around the room, throughout the ship, telltales winked to life. Warning lights began to flash and klaxons to sound. There was no one awake to hear them, but that did not affect the Sulaco's reaction. It was doing its job, complying with its programming. Meanwhile, smoke continued to billow from the ragged aperture in the floor. Atop Hicks's cylinder, the crawler humped obscenely as it continued to bleed destruction. A female voice, calm and serenely artificial, echoed unheard within the chamber. "Attention! Explosive gases are accumulating within the cryogenic compartment. Explosive gases are accumulating within the cryogenic compartment." Flush-mounted fans began to hum within the ceiling, inhaling the swirling, thickening gas. Acid continued to drip from the now motionless dead crawler. Beneath the floor, something exploded. Bright, actinic light flared, to be followed by a spurt of sharp yellow flame. Darker smoke began to mix with the thinner gases that now filled the chamber. The overhead lights flickered uncertainly. the exhaust fans, stopped. Fire in cryogenic compartment, the unperturbed female voice declared in the tone of something with nothing to lose. Fire in cryogenic compartment. A nozzle emerged from the ceiling, rotating like a miniature cannon. It halted, focusing on the flames and gas emerging from the hole in the floor. Liquid bubbled at its tip, gushed in the direction of the blaze. For an instant, the flames were subdued. Sparks erupted from the base of the nozzle. The burgeoning stream died, dribbling ineffectively from the powerhead. Fire suppression system inactivated. Fire suppression system inactivated. Exhaust system inactivated. Exhaust system inactivated. Fire and explosive gases in cryogenic chamber. Motors hummed to life. The four functioning cryonic cylinders rose from their cradles on hydraulic supports. Their telltales winking, they began to move to the far side of the room. Some smoke and intensifying flame obscured but did not slow their passage. Still pierced through by the chunk of metallic glass, the dead crawler slid off the moving coffin and fell to the floor. "All personnel report to EEV," the voice insisted, its tone unchanged. "Precautionary evacuation in 1 minute." Moving in single file, the cryonic cylinders entered a transport tube, travelled at high speed through the bowels of the ship until they emerged in the starboard lock, there to be loaded by automatic handlers into the waiting emergency escape vehicle. They were its only occupants. Behind the transparent faceplate, Newt twitched in her sleep. Lights flashed, motors hummed. The voice spoke, even though there were none to hear. "All EEVs will be jettisoned in 10 seconds. 9. Interior locks slammed shut. Externals opened wide. The voice continued its countdown. At zero, two things happened with inimical simultaneity. 10 EEVs, 9 of them empty, were ejected from the ship, and the proportion of escaping gases within the damaged cryonic chamber interacted critically with the flames that were emerging from the acid-leached hole in the floor. For a brief eruptive instant, the entire four-port side of the Sulaco blazed in fiery imitation of the distant stars. Half the fleeing EEVs were severely jolted by the explosion, completely out of control. One embarked upon a short, curving path which brought it back in a wide, sweeping arc to the ship from which it had been ejected. It did not slow as it neared its storage pod. Instead, it slammed at full acceleration into the side of the transport. A second, larger explosion rocked the great vessel. Wounded, it lurched onward through emptiness, periodically emitting irregular bursts of light and heat, while littering the immaculate void with molten, shredded sections of its irrevocably damaged self. On board the escape craft, containing the four cryonic cylinders, telltales were flashing, circuits flickering and sparking. The EEV's smaller, less sophisticated computers struggled to isolate, minimize, and contain the damage that had been caused by the last-second explosion. The vehicle had not been hulled, but the concussion had damaged sensitive instrumentation. It sought status clarification from the mothership, and when none was forthcoming, instigated a scan of its immediate surroundings. Halfway through the hasty survey, the requisite instrumentation failed, but it was quickly rejuvenated via a backup system. The Sulaco had been journeying far off the beaten photonic path, its mission having carried it to the fringes of human exploration. It had not travelled long upon its homeward path when overcome by disaster. Mankind's presence in this section of space was marked but intermittent, his installations far apart and few between. The EEV's guiding computer found something. Undesirable, not a primary choice, but under existing conditions it was the only choice. The ship could not estimate how long it could continue to function, given the serious nature of the damage it had suffered. Its primary task was the preservation of the human life it bore. A course was chosen and set. Still sputtering, striving mightily to repair itself, the compact vessel's drive throbbed to life. Fiorina wasn't an impressive world, and in appearance, even less inviting. But it was the only one in the Neroid sector with an active beacon. The EEV's data banks locked in on the steady signal. Twice, the damaged navigation system lost the beam, but continued on the prescribed course anyway. Twice, the signal was recovered. Information on Fiorina was scarce and dated, as befitted its isolation and peculiar status. Fiorina Fury 361, the readout stated. Outer Veil Mineral Ore Refinery. Maximum Security Work Correctional Facility. The words meant nothing to the ship's computer. They would have meant much to its passengers, but they were not in a position or condition to read anything. Additional information requested? The computer flashed plaintively. When the proper button was not immediately pressed, the screen obediently blanked. Days later, the EEV plunged towards the grey, roiling atmosphere of its destination. There was nothing inviting about the dark clouds that obscured the planetary surface. No glimpse of blue or green showed through them, no indication of life. But the catalogue indicated the presence of a human installation, and the communications beacon threw its unvarying pulse into emptiness with becoming steadiness. Onboard systems continued to fail with discouraging regularity. The EEV's computer strained to keep the craft under control as one backup after another kicked in. Clouds the colour of coal dust raced past the unoccupied ports as atmospheric lightning flashed threateningly off the chilled, sealed coffins within. The computer experienced no strain as it tried to bring the EEV down safely. There was no extra urgency in its efforts. It would have functioned identically had the sky been clear and the winds gentle, had its own internal systems been functioning optimally instead of flaring and failing with progressive regularity. The craft's landing gear had not responded to the drop command, and there was neither time nor power to try a second approach. Given the jumbled, precipitous nature of the landscape immediately surrounding the beacon and formal landing site, the computer opted to try for a touchdown on the relatively smooth sand beach. When additional power was requested, it developed that it did not exist. The computer tried, that was its job. But the EEV fell far short of the beach, slamming into the sea at too acute an angle. Within the compartment, braces and bulkheads struggled to absorb the impact. Metal and carbon composites groaned, buffeted by forces they were never intended to withstand. Support struts cracked or bent. Walls twisted. The computer concentrated all its efforts on trying to ensure that the four cylinders in its care remained intact. The crisis left little time for much else. About itself, the computer cared nothing. Self-care was not a function with which it had been equipped. The surface of Fiorina was as barren as its sky, a riot of grey-black stone scoured by howling winds. A few twisted, contorted growths clung to protected hollows in the rock. Driving rain agitated the surface of dank, cold pools. The inanimate shapes of heavy machinery dotted the mournful landscape. Loaders, transports, and immense excavators and lifters rested where they had been abandoned, too massive and expensive to evacuate from the incredibly rich site which had once demanded their presence. Three immense burrowing excavators sat facing the wind like a trio of gigantic carnivorous worms, their drilling snouts quiescent, their operator compartments dark and deserted. Smaller machines and vehicles clustered in groups like so many starving parasites, as if waiting for one of the larger machines to grind to life so that they might eagerly gather crumbs from its flanks. Below the site, dark breakers smashed methodically into a beach of gleaming black sand, expending their energy on a lifeless shore. No elegant arthropods skittered across the surface of that shadowy bay. No birds darted down on skilled, questing wings to probe the broken edges of the incoming waves for small, edible things. There were fish in the waters, though. Strange, elongated creatures with bulging eyes and small, sharp teeth. The human transients who called Fiorina home engaged in occasional arguments as to their true nature. But as these people were not the sort for whom a lengthy discussion of the nature of parallel evolution was the preferred mode of entertainment, they tended to accept the fact that the ocean-going creatures, whatever their peculiar taxonomy, were edible, and let it go at that. Fresh victuals of any kind were scarce. Better perhaps not to peer too deeply into the origins of whatever ended up in the cookpot, so long as it was palatable. The man walking along the beach was thoughtful and in no particular hurry. His intelligent face was preoccupied, his expression non-committal. Light plastic attire protected his perfectly bald head from the wind and rain. Occasionally, he kicked in irritation at the alien insects which swarmed around his feet, seeking a way past the slick, treated plastic. While Fiorina's visitors occasionally sought to harvest the dubious bounty of its difficult waters, the more primitive native life forms were not above trying to feast on the visitors. He strolled silently past abandoned derricks and fossilized cranes, wholly intent on his thoughts. He did not smile. His attitude was dominated by a quiet resignation, born not out of determination, but indifference, as though he cared little about what happened today, or whether there was a tomorrow. In any event, he found far more pleasure in gazing inward. His all-too-familiar surroundings gave him little pleasure. A sound caused him to look up. He blinked, wiping cold drizzle from his face mask. The distant roar drew his gaze to a point in the sky. Without warning, a lowering cloud gave violent birth to a sliver of descending metal. It glowed softly, and the air around it screamed as it fell. He gazed at the place where it had struck the ocean, pausing before resuming his walk. Halfway up the beach, he checked his chronometer, then turned and began to retrace his steps. Occasionally, he glanced out to sea. Seeing nothing, he expected to find nothing. So the limp form which appeared on the sand ahead of him was a surprise. He increased his pace slightly and bent over the body as wavelets lapped around his feet. For the first time, his blood began to race slightly. The body was that of a woman, and she was still alive. He rolled her over onto her back, stared down into Ripley's unconscious, salt-streaked face. He looked up, but the beach still belonged to him alone. Him, and this utterly unexpected new arrival. Leaving her to go for help would mean delaying treatment, which might save her life, not to mention exposing her to the small but still enthusiastic predators which inhabited parts of Fiorina. Lifting her beneath her arms, he heaved once and managed to get her torso around his shoulders. Legs straining, he lifted. With the woman on his shoulders and back, he headed slowly towards the weatherlock from which he'd emerged earlier. Inside, he paused to catch his breath, then continued on towards the bug wash. Three prisoners who'd been working outside were busy delousing, naked, beneath the hot, steady spray that mixed water with disinfectant. As medical officer, Clemens carried a certain amount of authority. He used it now. "Listen up." The men turned to regard him curiously. Clemens interacted infrequently with the prisoners, except for those who sought him out for sick call. Their initial indifference vanished as soon as they spotted the body hanging from his shoulders. "An EEV's come down." They exchanged glances. "Don't just stand there," he snapped, trying to divert their attention from his burden. "Get out on the beach. There may be others. And notify Andrews." They hesitated, then began to move. As they exited the wash and began grabbing at their clothes, they stared at the woman Clemens carried. He didn't dare set her down. We hope you enjoyed this free preview of Alien 3, the next installment in the Alien novelizations. To keep the story going, get the complete book today.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.